Welcome to the Wild Heart Meditation Center podcast. It is our intention to continue offering these audio recordings free of charge. However, if you would like to donate to support our cause in keeping our facility open in Nashville, you can do so via the Venmo app by sending a donation to @WildHeartNashville, or you can find us online at our website, wildheartmeditationcenter.org, and click the Donate tab. Tonight I wanted to talk about the topic of wise or appropriate effort in terms of how it relates to meditation practice. Wise effort is one of the factors of the Buddha's Eightfold Path, and it's said that he talked about effort more than any other factor of the Eightfold Path. One of the things that, if you come out to the groups on Sunday night, that I talk a lot about is the fruition of practice, meaning, you know, what is our aim for spiritual practice and what is the outcome or the result of developing a spiritual practice? And this is something that's been very important for me, because I think that in order to develop effort, we have to kind of ask ourselves the question, like, why do this? You know, why be interested in living in a way that we're connected with other people, and why be interested in non-harming, compassion, service, you know, some of these principles? I know for me that I've been in recovery for 13 years, and I still go to recovery meetings, and I very rarely have any desires or cravings to get high, but I still go. And sometimes I ask myself that question. It's like, why do I still like participate in recovery if I've been clean for 13 years? Right, and then I'll show up into these meetings and I'll hear people share and talk about their life and just getting clean, and I'm reminded of this like urgency that I had early on. You know, it's like almost I got kind of a little bit comfortable and just, you know, laying back into, you know, the benefits of my spiritual practice without really remembering why I did it. I've been doing it. This is one of the ways that the Buddha talked about wise effort, is this kind of enthusiasm, the motivation, the drive to do anything requires that we have some enthusiasm or some inspiration. Buddhism, part of this is the practice of what's called sada, or faith. I call it the F word. Faith in a Buddhist perspective is not about kind of ideology or belief. It's about experience, verified. What's working? What are the supports or the conditions for our well-being? You know, what are the fruits of our spiritual practices? And being able to like take refuge in our spiritual practices. I do this on a daily basis even, you know, like sitting in the morning and setting an intention for the day and, you know, trying to remind myself or remember this intention. And anyone that's had a spiritual practice, I think you'll see this is a really powerful thing to start the day off with some intention and to just keep coming back to that. I know when I rush into my day and I just, you know, go out into the world, my perspective can become very narrow. We talked about this a little bit last week. My perception of the world, my attitudes can really start to kind of close in around me and affects how I relate to people. And so what are we doing and why are we practicing? In particular, I want to talk about, you know, meditation, mindfulness. I think for the Buddha also, he, you know, was pretty unsatisfied with the happiness of the world. he was born into a wealthy family and was really cared for and was in the top, the class system in ancient India, but there was something that was fleeting about the worldly pleasures. And what he really did is he left home in search of a deeper abiding sense of happiness, what we might call in our path equanimity. And one of the fruits, one of the benefits of practicing meditation is we develop this quality of equanimity. In simple words, some of the words that we use, we may use the word serenity or acceptance, maybe even the word contentment. These words kind of come close to describing what equanimity is. But what equanimity really means is it's an ability to be with things as they are, right? As opposed to being with things the way that we want them to be. Being with things as they are immediately and directly. There's a really great simple quote by a guy named Ajahn Sumedho. He says, right now it's like this. It's kind of like waking up into the moment. We talk a lot about awakening. And it's not our fault that the mind has preferences. The nervous system, biologically, it likes to feel comfort. And it rebels against discomfort. Right? There are preferences in the people that we choose or want to be around, and the amount of money we want to make, and the circumstances and situations and conditions of our life. We have preferences, and those are okay, but equanimity is about learning how to be with conditions as they are. And that our happiness, from a Buddhist perspective, doesn't depend upon the conditions in our life, but how we relate to the conditions of our life. And so it's this subtle shift in that I won't ever find lasting happiness in the people, places, and things. Because the people, the places, and the things, they change. But I can find a deeper sense, an abiding happiness or equanimity in learning how to be with conditions as they are, and learning how to, as we say, see clearly and respond wisely. Practice wisdom and compassion. To be able to say, hey, right now it's like this. What is this? How is it? What does it need? Equanimity is a creative engagement with the present experience. And so instead of just having to do what we always do, our automatic kind of reactions to things, we're able to pause. With a mindfulness practice, we're able to kind of pause and rest back into that experience and to have the ability to choose our response. And that's what Viktor Frankl says, our freedom lies in that pause, that moment between a stimulus and response. He said there's a space. And that space, being able to sit in the space, is where we cultivate and develop equanimity. When the urges arise during meditation, we sit in that space. I call it urge surfing. You'll notice, sometimes 20, 30 times in one meditation practice, the inclination to get up and do something else. Right? And that's just how the mind is. So we're not resisting or arguing with the mind. We're saying, okay, mind, I see you. I know you, I care about you, but not right now. The Pali Sanskrit word for equanimity means, the word is upekkha, and when translated it means there in the middleness. Being able to be in the middle of whatever we find ourselves in. An argument, a disagreement, even some delight and celebration, excitement, being able to even be in the middle of those moments. And the hard part about the human condition is that life is so ephemeral, it's so transient and changing, that every moment is a new moment. And there are new conditions, there are new sounds and new feelings and new thoughts, and everything's new all the time. And the mind wants to create some type of environment where it can be stable and fixed and comfortable. But the Buddha is saying the world's not actually like that. So we have this mind that has preference for a permanent, fixed world, a comfortable world, but we have an experience, a reality that's not that way. But through mindfulness, we can learn how to abide in a sense of that moment of pause, to be with the experience, and to learn how to respond and engage more creatively. If it's painful, we can learn to practice compassion. Just like we would with someone else that's going through pain. I'm so sorry. I care about you. Being able to open and embrace the experience with a heart that cares instead of argues, resents, blames. If the experience is pleasant, learning how to practice non-attached appreciation. Easier said than done, but being able to delight in, to take active delight in these temporary moments of joy and happiness. So equanimity means there in the middleness. I like to say, Buddhist practice is not about any ideology or even philosophy, really. It's about trying to live with wise view, living in a way that is in line with how things are in actuality. There's a really great quote by Alan Watts. He said, "Whether we like it or not, change comes. And the greater the resistance, the greater the pain. Buddhism perceives the beauty of change, for life is like music in this. If any note or phrase is held for longer than its appointed time, the melody is lost. Thus, Buddhism may be summed up in two phrases: let go and walk on. Drop the craving for self, for permanence, for particular circumstances, and go straight ahead with the movement of life." Like I said, our happiness, it really does come through how we relate to the conditions of our life, not the conditions themselves. And it's not to say that we don't have aspirations to, have certain conditions in our life. Some of us want a partner and a certain job, and that's okay, but it's really in how we move towards our aspirations, not the aspirations themselves. It's okay to want, but to demand or to argue with the way things are, that's when we really suffer. So one of the fruits of meditation practice is learning how to practice non-reactive awareness, equanimity. And in the beginning, you may be like me, where it's like you sit and you close your eyes and it's just like, the whole thing is a reaction. I've told this story quite a bit, but when I first started meditating, I came to this center when we were at a different location because I was so riddled with anxiety and depression that I was finally willing to try anything. I was like, all right, meditation? Cool, I'll give it a try. I remember closing my eyes and being so overwhelmed by anxiety that I just thought everyone was looking at me, and I had this feeling someone was going to come in and just smack me over the head with a bat, which sounds really violent, but that's literally the feeling that I had in my mind. And so, yeah, there's a lot of reactivity, there's a lot of emotion, there's a lot going on in here. I said last week, one of my favorite quotes by one of Joseph Goldstein's teachers, Menindraji, he said, if you want to understand your mind, you have to sit down and watch it. Right? If you want to develop equanimity, we have to sit down and be with these parts of ourselves. It's very counterintuitive in some ways. It's like, if I'm anxious, why would I want to sit with my anxiety? Makes no sense. Isn't there something out here in the world that could just take care of my anxiety for me? Sure, there are things that can help. I mean, you know, friends and medicine and, you know, all sorts of things can help with my anxiety. But at the end of the day, the anxiety lives in this body. And so being able to turn towards and to, like, meet that part of ourselves and say, I feel you, I'm here for you. Just letting that anxiety just riddle through the body like an earthquake. And sometimes we need to have some back off strategies. You know, it's not always just sit with. Sometimes it's good to use some other forms of mindfulness, walking meditation. Sometimes I'll put on my favorite CD if I'm really tripping about something, just go for a walk for like an hour. You know, using some like healthy ways to kind of back off out of the emotions, those are helpful. But by and large, through mindfulness, we're learning how to be with. And this means that we start to see the parts of our experience, thoughts, emotions, feelings, not as the culmination of who we are, but just parts of our experience. So that means a thought's just a thought. Now, a thought's very powerful because a thought is often about me, and it's about my life, and it's about how good or bad I'm doing. It's about my future. Thoughts are very powerful, but thoughts really through mindfulness is about looking at just a thought is just a thought. A feeling's a feeling, an emotion's an emotion. And this is a powerful insight through mindfulness practice. We start to develop a little bit of inner space and to be able to practice this non-reactive awareness and just to say, oh, I see you, mind. I feel you, body. Equanimity is one of the fruits of practice. Another fruit of the practice is the development of wisdom or clarity. So as we practice non-reactive awareness, we're able to start to see, you know, we start to see the mind with more clarity. We start to see the mental states and patterns and habits like we did tonight in the practice. We start to see the subtle attitude of wanting or not wanting. We start to see the urges. We start to see the planning. We start to see the pain that arises when we have a sound that comes up in the moment. So this type of wisdom is developed experientially. It's by being present and aware that we start to learn things about the nature of the mind. We start to see the conditioned habits. I talked about last week some of the powerful habits of the mind. And one of my favorites is like the experience of loneliness. This is something that I mentioned last week I've been very familiar with throughout my life. And it was really a gift to start to practice meditation and learn how to become more intimate with my mind's stories about loneliness. You know, start to see the mind that, you know, was alone and that felt like I was always going to be alone. And on the opposite end, the mind that didn't want to have anything to do with anybody. The world's a fucked up place. You're better off alone. And then the other stories in another powerful emotion and mind state of shame. Not good enough. like I said last week, Brené Brown calls this the inner hustler. It's the part of the mind that's comparing and competing, you know, constantly looking at how we fit in or don't fit in. The sense of separateness was one of the biggest delusions that the Buddha was really interested in looking at and developing wisdom around, is this sense of feeling separate from. That there's something so uniquely wrong with me. Everyone else is just, yeah, people struggle, but there's something really wrong with me. You know, the mind is so powerful in the way that it convinces us. You know, I shared last week this experience I had on a retreat where, you know, towards the end of the retreat, people were offering their gratitude to the teacher. And everyone was just sharing this like outpouring of love for him. And I just felt like there was this force field of love, and I was just sitting right outside of it. You know, like everyone was included, and it was a feeling. I didn't even have a thought like I'm a piece of shit or anything. I just felt separate. I was like, I'm not included in this. And if I pay attention, that happens a lot in social situations. It's like you walk in, everyone else seems to be, that's shame. That's the feeling of shame. It's a powerful feeling. So if we can learn how to have equanimity, we can have this kind of ability to see with non-reactive awareness, to see and say, oh yeah, I see you, shame. All right. And in the seeing, there's this, the shame loses a little bit of its power because there's less of me in it. There's just feeling. There's just thought. There's just emotion. So we're learning how to be with experience, but we're also learning how to develop discernment and to seeing clearly the states and habits of mind. The states and habits of mind that are destructive, that are repetitive and conditioned, but are destructive, and the states and habits of mind that are supportive. And this is where wise effort comes in, is learning to discern what states and habits of mind are supportive or skillful and what states and habits of mind are unskillful, unsupportive. This is how the Buddha puts it. I like reading the Buddha's discourses because, you know, these things were oral traditions for a few hundred years, and then they were written and recorded around 24 CE. And it just blows my mind that the Buddha was able to really be interested in the mind so deeply without any neuroscience, without any like psychological research, or just by sitting down and watching the mind. And so when I read this, I always like just thinking about how this is like 2,600 years old. And so this teaching is on mindfulness of the mind and wise effort. And he says, in practicing mindfulness of mind, one knows a lustful, greedy, or craving mind to be lustful, greedy, or craving. And a mind without lust, greed, or craving to be without lust, greed, or craving. One knows an aversive, resentful, or ill will filled mind to be a mind of aversion, resentment, or ill will. And a mind without aversion, resentment, or ill will to be without aversion, resentment, or ill will. And one knows a deluded mind to be deluded, confused, or bewildered, and a mind without delusion to be without delusion, confusion, and bewilderment. Repetitive, but really interesting, because what the Buddha is saying is we're just noticing the mind as it is in this non-reactive way. So once again, he's saying we're not trying to fix, change, or control the mind. We're just noticing the mind state that's present or all of the mind states that aren't. And this is another interesting part of this too, is we commonly, you know, automatically will know when a mind state, or I should say we more often will know when a mind state's present than when it's absent. For example, is your mind filled with anger right now? Mine's not. Check that one off the list. Is your mind filled with greed right now? Is the mind resentful? And so what he's asking is not just to notice the moments when the mind is emotional or when certain mental states are present, but he's also asking us to notice when those mind states have passed and are not present any longer. Last week I talked about my experiences with depression and how this actually very practice was really helpful to me. Because when I was experiencing depression, it seemed like this cloud, like Charlie Brown and the cloud that just followed me everywhere I went. And my depression felt like this static state. It was like this wet blanket that I just always was in. But when I really started to practice mindfulness, I noticed that there were moments when the depression was a little bit less. And there were moments when I was even completely free of that, you know, tone or mode of, however you want to describe it, but of negativity, cynicism, criticism. That's how my depression manifested. So being able to just track these mind states and to just note, like we did tonight, wanting, not wanting, noticing when there's craving in the mind or anticipation, right? That 5 minutes before the end of the group, what am I going to watch on Netflix? Am I going to go through the Taco Bell drive-through, right? Like it's like already the mind is anticipating, planning. No big deal, right? Equanimity means non-reactive. Okay, cool. The mind, that's wanting. Know that. If right now you're chilling and you're like, man, I love being in here. This room's cool. I'm listening to this guy in the moment. You may not have wanting in your mind. So notice that too. Of course, we can't like all day long just sit and maybe we could on retreat. You have more opportunity to practice noticing the mind in this kind of subtle way all day long. But even a little bit at the beginning of the day, just noticing the quality of the mind and throughout the day, checking in. Like we talk about, I'm a social worker, therapist, we talk a lot about like checking in. You check in with people about their week, you check in with people about how they're doing with the breakup, right? But what about just checking in the moment with the mind and being like, what is this like right now in the mind? And we're bringing particular attention to unskillful or what's sometimes called unwholesome roots of mind. So these are our mind states that tend to cause us a lot of trouble. In traditional Buddhist terms, they're called the kilesas or the defilements. I like the definition for defilement. It sounds like such a heavy, like biblical word. It's like sinfulness in the mind. But what defilements mean is it means something that pollutes, corrupts, covers, or spoils the beauty and purity of something or someone. So it's something that pollutes, corrupts, covers, or spoils the beauty and purity of something or someone. And traditionally, the three kilesas or the three defilements or coverings, sometimes they're called, are greed, hatred, and delusion. And these can be really heavy words. It's like, yeah, okay, I don't want to have a greedy mind or a mind filled with hatred or delusion. But in the subtle levels, greed could be anything from that anticipation we talked about earlier to kind of a subtle sense of restlessness to a sense of craving or obsessing, to full-blown like greed, which is like maybe our moments of just wanting to, you know, go for world domination. And hatred can be even more subtle, I feel like. It can be irritability, subtle aversion, contracting in the body. It can be an irritability, a hatred. It can also be ill will, like resentment, blaming. You ever rehearse in your mind what you're going to say to someone? The argument you're going to have later? And just being able to see, like, this has been really powerful in retreat, because you get into a retreat practice, and if, you know, you're there for a week, let's say, and you go in day one, and all of a sudden the person that's just been grinding your gears comes into your mind, and you just start thinking about what they did and what you're going to say, and that rehearsing comes up. Day one goes by, rehearsing, rehearsing, rehearsing. Wake up the next day. All right, try to notice the rehearsing. Come back. Let it go. The rehearsing comes back up. Just rehearsing, rehearsing, rehearsing. Right? How painful it is to be just caught up in that resentment. Right? Other than the actual pain of maybe the like fragmented relationship or whatever it is that's painful about that, there's the pain of just mulling it over. There's the, you know, heaviness of that resentment in the mind. Delusion can be anything from just being checked out to simple fantasy, right, which they call non-afflictive delusion. It's kind of like harmless fantasizing about stuff. And this can turn into other types of delusion, like comparing, like we talked about earlier. Or self-obsession, self-consciousness. You know, the mind that says, I think I'm being pretty weird right now. Am I weird? Was I weird? Was I weird earlier when I talked to that person? I think I was pretty weird. I'm never going to go to a party ever again. I'm just so weird. It's like you got to look at the mind and be like, who's in here with this opinion? Everyone's pretty fucking weird if you actually think about it. We're all very weird. There's nothing normal about this whole experience we call being human. It's a very weird thing. But the mind says, oh no, I'm very weird though. And so we want to look at this kind of spectrum of what's called the defilements or these coverings, right? Because not that these things are bad or sinful, but that they get in our way. They cover up really the beauty of a mind that is at ease. We're able to start to practice through wise effort, noticing these states of mind. Preventing, as it says up here, the first effort, preventing these unskillful, unwholesome states from arising in the first place. And we'll talk about this in a second. Abandoning the unskillful, unwholesome states once they've already risen into the mind. Cultivating and developing wholesome or skillful states of mind and maintaining wholesome and skillful states of mind once they've arisen. So I want to say one more thing about defilements and the way it looking at how do we develop non-reactive awareness of these mind states. It's by reading a quote from Joseph Goldstein. He said, although discerning what is skillful from unskillful is basic to the Buddha's teaching, in our Western culture, it's a very delicate process. For many people, it's an easy step from recognizing a particular mind state, like greed or hatred, as being unwholesome, to feeling that you're a bad person for having it. Or that somehow it's wrong for the mind state to even arise in the first place. This pattern of reaction simply leads to more self-judgment, more aversion, and more suffering. It's not a helpful cycle. And this is why if you go to any even secular class on mindfulness, they emphasize so much this non-judgmental awareness. What I might call a non-reactive or a kind or gentle awareness. Whatever is in the mind, no big deal. That's how it is. Pema Chodron said, it is only when we begin to relax with ourselves that meditation becomes a transformative process. Only when we relate with ourselves without moralizing, without harshness, without deception, can we let go of harmful patterns. Without kindness and non-judgment, letting go of old habits becomes abusive. This is an important point. So some of the wholesome, skillful habits of mind we're trying to cultivate is a quality called metta, or kindness, a friendly, kind attitude or quality of mind. And I like to think of these qualities of mind in terms of relationships. So I actually, when I'm thinking about developing kindness, what does that even look like? What is that even like in my mind? I try to think about, like, how would I ideally be with, like, a little kid? You know, like, if a kid was, like, hard on themselves and saying, you know, I'm just so weird. I just don't fit in, right? Like, how would I reassure that kid? I'd say, you know, I know what that's like. I understand. I see you. I care about you. May you be at ease, right? These are some of the kind of relational qualities of loving kindness or metta. And it helps, this is a really powerful practice, to be able to look into the mind throughout the day and even look at the tone of your inner voice. Is the tone harsh? Is it demanding? And being able to kind of soften the tone, even. You know, practicing compassion, empathy, gratitude, appreciation. So the four great efforts is something I want to talk about tonight in our discussion, too, are written up here on the board. And the first is to prevent the arising of unskillful states that have not yet arisen. This is what's called protective awareness. And the Buddha says if we want a mind that's not like totally covered in defilements, we've got to really protect our mind from things that give rise to those states. So one example I like to use, I mentioned earlier, I'm in recovery. They used to say that if you don't want to get your hair cut, don't go to the barber shop, right? Like if you don't want to get high, don't go to the dope house. Don't go to the party or don't go to the, you know, hang out with your drug dealer, especially early on in recovery. So we need to be a little bit wise about the company we keep. And the Buddha calls this wise association. One of the ways to protect our mind is to look at the company we keep. That's a form of protective awareness. Another form of protective awareness is being careful with our consumption. You know, what do we ingest? What do we take in? I don't mean just through our mouths. I mean through our brains. And they call this guarding the senses or sense restraint. Being a little bit careful about, you know, what are the... There's so much just stimulation in the world. You know, like how much am I taking in and what am I taking in? And we can start to be a little bit protective of the mind just by shoring that up a little bit. You know, making a commitment and living with these precepts of non-harming. You know, to not take what's not offered to us, to not intentionally cause harm or hurt other beings, to be wise and careful with our sexual energy, to be wise and careful in the ways we communicate, to be wise and careful with our ingesting of intoxicants, right? Because once we start to let some of those things slip, the regret and the remorse and all these mind states start to just fly into the brain. And so that's one way we can prevent the arising of unskillful states, is just to be a little bit careful about our behavior. The mind, thoughts are an inner behavior. If we want to have some like healthy inner behavior or outer behavior is a great place to start. And that's the basis of behavioral psychology, is whatever you practice, you get better at. And happiness is a collection of good habits. So if I'm doing things that I don't value, the shame, the regret, the remorse, more obsession, more craving, more self-consciousness, those things are going to start to arise in the mind. The second is to abandon unwholesome states that have already arisen. You know, this is a practice of learning how to patiently bear with mind states and to talk ourselves through them. I call this the coach, right? Like when I'm tripping about something and I'm able to just kind of sit back and say, oh shit, I'm really tripping right now, and to be able to talk myself through it and to say, you're frustrated, you're upset, you're irritable, that's just how it is right now, I see you, right? But not feeding the story. And so this is a really helpful practice around abandoning unwholesome mind states, is to try to drop out of the story and just to get down into the body with the feeling, just that primary feeling, and see if you can linger in that feeling and just ride it out. And as soon as the feeling wants to jump back up into the story, just drop back down in the body, ride it out. That helps us to kind of start to let go of those. The Buddha calls it papancha, which I like because it's a Pali Sanskrit word, but it's an onomatopoeia. It sounds like what it is. Mental proliferation, the spreading out and getting bigger of the stories of our mind. So one of the ways is to learn how to let go of the story and come back into the feeling, the felt sense. The third is to cultivate wholesome states. So the simple things like gratitude list. This is such an easy way to cultivate wholesome states, and I won't go into it, but there's a lot of research around having like a daily gratitude list. It's so simple, but there's a positive psychologist in North Carolina, I forget her name, but she studied extensively the benefits of this, and there's this positive reinforcement loop that starts to happen when we practice actively looking for things that we're grateful for. Is that you start to see them more if you're looking for them. Gratitude's not a passive quality. It's not a feeling. That feeling is maybe joy or delight. But gratitude is actually an inquiring. It's trying to cultivate a wholesome mind state. It's trying to say, yeah, there's tons of shit in my life that's not going my way, and we're not going to discount that. That's important. And there's this stuff too. You know, it helps to widen the view and build a skillful mind. And then the third is maintenance. This is especially for long-term practice, or you know, people that have had a spiritual practice for a while. We keep, you know, coming back to the basics over and over again. It's like I said in the beginning, remembering why we came here, and you know, kind of continuing to maintain and to be interested in our spiritual practices and to get support with them.